गुरवे गौरचंद्राय राधिकाय तदालय कृष्णाय कृष्ण भक्ताय थार भक्ताय नमो नमः। सो गुड मॉर्निंग टू ऑल ऑफ यू फ्रॉम आनंद आश्रम इन नॉर्थ कैरोलिना एंड हैप्पी टू बी बैक आफ्टर 1 week of मिसिंग आवर Mr. Gusti, not the first time, of course, but yeah, last week we were in New York, as you know, and specifically on the particular day of our Mr. Gusti, there was a celebration of Sri Rath Yatra. So I was invited there. Originally, I was supposed to travel on that day, and I didn't know there was Rath Yatra, so I was invited. So I changed my ticket to the next day and participated in the festival of Sri Jagannath Baladev and Subhadra. So it was very nice. Like, I don't know how many devotees, I was not able to count them, as you can imagine, but approx a few thousands for sure. So yeah, it was one of those few rare moments where you see devotees everywhere, like oceanic dimensions. Although I'm more of a private person and I feel more comfortable in small groups, it's also nice to, for a moment, jump and swim into an ocean of devotees and meeting old friends, new friends, darshan, kirtan, sharing prasad, and so on. So it was dynamic, intense experience. Not only Rath Yatra, the whole New York visit in New Jersey, as you may have seen some pictures, we were invited to do some programs in some houses, in some churches, in different places. So it's an interesting visit as usual. So happy to be back here with all of you. Also, before forgetting, I was just notified a few minutes ago that a friend of ours, Sudharma Dasi, she's a Prabhupada disciple, she passed away last night. Maybe some of you may recall her. We invited her to our pre-radical podcast a few months ago. So we had a very nice, kind conversation. So I just want to mention this for a few minutes so we can also pray for her. No, I mean the transition from, I mean, she lived, as we were talking today with Sumati, a very dedicated life in service to Mahaprabhu, Sri Radha Krishna, Srila Prabhupada, his mission. So in one sense we need her prayers, in one sense, but also it's always a very, I would say, how to say, very beautiful gift and contribution to pray for someone who is in a special soul, to who can always become more special. And in moments of transition, everyone's prayers are counting. Everything creates an impact and influence. We are not devoid of influence. We are all always being influenced by each other, by environment, by so many things at the same time. Krishna himself has been influenced. He's influencing us as well. So the more we can voluntarily invest, yeah, our time and energy in creating favorable influences, I think it's one of the best things we can do with our time. So at least for a few seconds, I invite all of you to, we can close our eyes and just try to concentrate our, yeah, our will, our intention, our well-wishing in the direction of Sudharma Dasi's soul, Sudharma Dasi, in this transition from one life to the next. I'm praying for blessings, praying for the best, praying for a smooth transition. Transition moments are very, very important. Of course, not only transition moments are very important, but collective prayer is very important and powerful. So that's why we are inviting here all of you to align hearts and mind and voice and prayer to bless, to extend blessings, to request blessings as well. So thanks so much for joining us in prayer for this is Tagosti. And that said, we will start more officially with our meeting today. I see that there are a few hands raised. Also, I have a question that was sent to me a few weeks ago, actually, and I forgot to address it in our last Istogosti, but we did. So, if you give me permission, both Kevin Rasangi, I will start with that question because it's waiting for almost a month at this point. So, I'll go there and then we can address whatever questions you may have, those connected live. So, this is a question from Kishore Krishna Prabhu from Florida, from Alachua, I think he lives there. And he asks the following. From your presentation, I understand guru means ideal representation of Krishna. But sometimes an individual guru may not meet such standard. Therefore, is it offensive for a disciple to question the guru's incomplete representation of Krishna, since a disciple is supposed to have unwavering faith that Sri Guru is Sakshat Haritvina, or none different from Hari? Where does a disciple draw a line of guru aparad by questioning the guru? Okay. Thanks for your question, Kishore Krishna Prabhu. And of course, we have talked about this many times, and we need to continue talking about this many times, since not only the topics are inexhaustible, but also, how to say, our capacity to forget some things is inexhaustible as well. So sometimes we need to remind each other of things that we heard already a few times, and we need to hear them so many times because we hear the opposite of that many more times. So it's a matter of counteracting certain biases or assumptions or prejudices or misconceptions that we may have acquired or whatever the case. So I'll go to the different parts of the question. So first thing he says that from my presentation, he understands that guru means ideal representation of Krishna. Yeah, I mean, that's what Shastra says every time, most of the times, unless it clarifies that. Most of the times Shastra speaks about guru, it takes for granted that that person representing the department of guru is an ideal representative. So that's like the idealism, if you want to put it like that. No, the guru's idealized as perfect, whenever it's talked about guru in a general way, like implying ideally a guru is, yeah, a perfect representative of Krishna. Like I give the example in radical personalism. Like when we hear a description of an apple, we will hear a description of an ideal apple, not a rotten apple, an apple cut in half or anything, but complete, round, red, juicy, tasty, sweet apple. So in the same way, when Shastra says guru, it has a certain level of representation in mind, which is an ideal one. As you mentioned, of course, being realistic, not necessarily every individual guru may meet such a standard. And I think it's important to clarify here something, which is ideal representative of guru doesn't necessarily mean Uttam Bhagavat or the topmost devotee. Of course, the topmost devotee is an ideal representative of Krishna as a guru. But someone may not be an Uttam Bhagavat, may not be in the highest level of divine love realization, but that person, he or she, may be, let's say, a Madhyam Bhakta, but that person is on his intermediate level. That person is 100 sincere, 108% sincere, honest, transparent, surrender, according to the level where he or she is. So in that sense, that person is an ideal representative of Krishna, because despite not being as, so to say, developed in terms of pure love, his openness and willingness to be an instrument of Krishna's message makes him what Prabhupada will call a transparent via medium. So despite that devotee may be, again, to give an example on the Madhyam platform, an Uttam or higher current can be revealed through that person. So in that sense, we will say that person is an ideal representative of Krishna. Krishna can be fully expressed through that person also. So in one sense, it's not so much about if it's an Uttam Mahabhagavat or Uttam Uttam or Madhyam. It's what's the level of sincerity, openness, surrender. Because one can be a Kanishtha and Madhyam and be fully surrendered according to the capacities one has in that particular stage. So that fullness of willingness and disposition and openness invites for an equally full expression of Krishna through that person. You follow my point? So I think that's an important point to mention when we say ideal representative of Krishna. Because many times we, in our minds, we put that, okay, that means sometimes even we go beyond Uttam Bhagavat. It has to be Nitya Siddha, eternally liberated, which again, as we talk many times, there's no way we can establish that either. No, how can we establish someone is an eternally liberated soul or all that stuff? Even most people may not know how to establish if someone is a Uttam Bhagavat or Madhyam Bhagavat, etc. So anyhow, going to the question, after clarifying this, he asks, Krishna asks, is it offensive for the disciple to question the guru's incomplete representation of Krishna? So again, here we are not talking about Madhyam Uttam, but incomplete representation, which in my interpretation, which I don't know if it's the same as Krishna's, will be someone is not as surrendered, sincere, and transparent, and therefore there is some blockage, so to say, in the representation, in God's expression through that person, and many times some other things get in the way of God's will, and it has more to do with the person's whatever limitations, unresolved stuff that gets in the way of delivering Krishna to others. That's how I take it, incomplete representation, right? Because again, if your guru is a Madhyam Bhakta and he's fully sincere and open, what can you tell that person? No? There's something lacking in you because you are still not an Uttam Bhagavat, but that person is doing all that he, she can, and it's fully transparent, and it's only a matter of time that that person will become an Uttam Bhagavat. So to point you are not still an Uttam Bhagavat, or to consider that an incomplete representation, that will be Guru Aparat. So by incomplete representation, naturally is what I'm mentioning now here. So it's not offensive in that case, of course, for a disciple to question the Guru's incomplete representation of Krishna. No, it's not an offense. Of course, there's a way to question. Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita will say, Tadviti pranipatena pari prashnena sevaya. So he mentions these three main duties of the disciple, right? Which is interesting, as I mentioned many times. Every time we go to the main verses in scripture that speak about the qualities of the guru, the qualities of the disciple are mentioned first. And many times in bigger detail than the qualities of the guru, like implying you are looking for a guru, but first look for the disciple in yourself. How much you are willing to be a disciple, that will determine how much you will be able to find your guru. Because if you are not willing to be a disciple, your guru may be right in front of you, and there is no guru because there is no disciple yet. So anyhow, in these main verses, one of them is this verse that I quoted from the Gita, chapter 4, verse 34, Krishna says, Tadvidi pranipatena pariprasnena sevaya. These three duties of the disciple is first, surrender. We already talked many times how ideally surrender has to be prefaced by awe and wonder, and not by coercion, intimidation, and fear, social pressure, etc. And then he says, pariprasnena sevaya. Pariprasnena is translated sometimes like humble inquiry, and sevaya means service. So I like to concentrate on pariprasnena. Actually, pariprasnena can be translated, of course, humble inquiry. Humility has to be there always. Pariprasnena, prashna means to present a question, but pari also means like exhaustively, like to inquire, in a very exhaustive way. Like when you say parikram, and parikram is like you are walking around something, like you are surrounding something, and from all possible places you are walking around it, like exhaustive, not circumambulation. So pariprasnena means like to question from all angles possible, to question in a humble way, again, not in a challenging way, attacking the person insulting, but to be comprehensive in your quest for the truth, basically. That's this the duty of a disciple is to present that level of inquiry. Ambayabhyatireka sarvada, says the one of the Chaturshloki verses in the Bhagavatam. Etavati and so on so forth. Which means indirectly, directly, in every place, in every situation, that should be the spirit of looking for the truth. So all this translated in this situation means a disciple has to ask, has to present questions. Sometimes the question will be more of a philosophical nature, theological nature, scriptural doubts, some more with a personal, whatever, faith crisis or struggles in one's daily life. I mean, it's not that only one type of question is allowed. And sometimes the question may be, hopefully not, but sometimes that can happen if the guru is not behaving properly or misrepresenting or doing that partially. The disciple can ask about that. Can ask about that. In some cases, maybe the guru was actually doing fine and the disciple misperceived that as a misrepresentation. But in some cases, there may be a misrepresentation, an incomplete representation, a distorted representation. And of course, it's a complex situation, as you may know, because for a disciple is not expecting that to happen. But if it happens, for example, Narahari Sarkar describes in Krishna Bhajanamrita, if one sees that one's guru is walking into the wrong path, so to say, behaving in a way guru should not behave, and that starts to happen once, twice. Once in the beginning is not wanting to see that naturally, we cannot believe that even, and one maybe will doubt one's own perception, but eventually in time one realizes this is not going well, this is not correct. And so the disciples should approach the guru, he says, in a humble mood and point to those things in the spirit of service to the guru. Like, Gurudev, I'm seeing that you are doing this, and this is against the teachings you gave me. You taught me this all these years, and now you're behaving in another direction. So that's not healthy for me. That's not healthy for you. So, with all the love and affection that I have for you, in service to you, I'm pointing to the thing. So we can you can go back to the right path, and we can continue serving together. Why not? There's place for that. That's mentioned by Narahari Sarkar Thakur in Krishna Bhajanamrita. So there is a way to do that. Again, in intimacy, with affection, in the spirit of service, having gone through some period of time of questioning oneself, observing something that is not correct, that happens over and over. It's not that just something happens and I'm just already like denouncing my guru publicly or rejecting him or her. We are not saying that. There is a way to do that, no? But if some dysfunctionality becomes more and more apparent and obvious, okay, there is a place for bringing that to the table in a healthy conversation. So in that sense, that's not aparat. Again, that's guru seva, technically speaking. Although externally it may seem like aparat. How do you dare to tell that to your guru? Well, so many times we may hear those types of narrative, which are more like cultish, in my opinion. Like nobody, you never can say anything, and that opens the door for abuse if something is not going right. But also we are not saying just say anything and everything in a rebel, violent, insulting way, ungrateful. Now nobody's saying that, but the middle point between these two. Nor naivete, nor cynicism or resentfulness. No, but proper mature approach in the spirit of service, with affection, with objective, how to say, observations about what's going wrong, because also you're gonna just come to your guru and say, "Well, Gurudev, I feel that you are not representing Krishna properly." And the guru say, "Why?" "I just feel it." No, it doesn't help too much the conversation to be that abstract. So one has to go with something concrete, objective, that we can talk about it. And ideally, the guru, if that's correct, if the disciple is not just hallucinating, the guru should be willing to entertain those doubts and to reply to those openly and humbly, and being willing to hold himself, herself accountable, and even apologize Why not? No, that's also part of the journey and the process. And if that's happening ideally, and I talked about that on some degree in Radical Personalism, in the chapter on issues and tissues between guru and disciple, there is some section about that, whether on being rejected by the guru and having to leave one's guru and how to navigate all those dynamics. But there's place for that. And if that's happening nicely and in a healthy way, that's inspiring for everyone. Because both guru and disciple are serving together. It's a teamwork. Both are honoring the same cause. So again, that should be happening. Of course, again, we should be having, because the last part of the question, and with this I'm concluding, says, disciple is supposed to have unwavering faith that three gurus like Shaktarit Bina to want to draw the line. Again, you draw the line when you feel that that's not happening, that Sakshatari is not being manifested through that person. When some particular situation is not in line with Krishna's will, and as he himself expresses what's his will, what Shastra says, even with the teachings of that same person that is supposed to represent Krishna. So, yeah, we have to have unwavering faith as long as the guru is representing Sri Guru as a department, as we always say. The guru as Vyasti, as an individual, is an agent that is supposed to be a transparent representative, a transparent agent of the agency of Guru Tattva, Samashti Guru, Krishna himself, the principle of divine revelation that takes endless forms. Ultimately, Guru Tattva is in everything. Mahaprabhu will look at the grass or at the tree and he finds Guru Tattva there. So ultimately, guru, it's not just limited to one person, to my guru, to the parampara. We know guru is a universal principle of divine revelation. That's basically Guru Tattva, the agency of divine revelation, whatever form that takes. Sometimes I mentioned this because sometimes we are very reductionistic and we just limit Guru Tattva to a human being, a Diksha guru, my parampara, and period. And that's not correct. Guru Tattva potentially is everywhere. Of course, we don't have generally the capacity to extract Guru Tattva from everywhere. And that's why a personalized teacher is required for us to be trained and develop the eye to find Guru Tattva everywhere. So, yeah, as long as that personal teacher and representative is transparent, be a medium, surrender, sincere, fully, there is no need to. We can have an unwavering faith in that level of representation. But when something gets in the way, it's not healthy to force ourselves to have unwavering faith in that direction. Because that's when we start talking about blind faith and many other things. So, some thoughts. I hope that helps to the question and the topic in general. So, that's it. Sorry for my extension, but we have three more hands raised now. So, we'll go to the next question by Kevin, so you can unmute yourself, please.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
I've been studying the concept of sacrifice in scripture and Shastra, and I really have to confess I'm overwhelmed by it. There's so much about sacrifice, and it seems to me that sacrifice can be made as a transaction and also be made out of love without expectation of anything in return. And yet, it also seems that when an offering is made in devotion or love, it can also be transactional. For example, when Advaita Acharya makes an offering to Krishna in the form of tulasi leaf and water, he's doing it with the expectation of obtaining a result to get Krishna, right? To incarnate. And even the language in that part of the Adi Lila is really transactional. It uses words like selves and repay a debt and liquidate a debt, you know? So it seems very transactional in that languaging. So I suppose that my question comes down to this. If, as I understand love by its very nature, love is not transactional. It seems that Shastra offers examples when it actually is. So as such, I guess From a Gaudiya perspective, does love have a transactional quality to it? There you
Okay,
go.
thank you. Thank you for the question. Of course, maybe it all depends also what we mean by love. Because again, we use the word, but for different people, it means different things. And according to definition of love, we could say some definitions correspond with transactional dynamics, while others are purely in terms of non-transactional dynamics. So I will also make a difference between transactional and probably reciprocal, because sometimes, of course, love is reciprocal, but that love is reciprocal doesn't mean that love is necessarily transactional in terms of each other having this particular expectation in mind, like by doing this, I will receive that, and so on. So yeah, as you mentioned in the scriptures, the concept of sacrifice, whether it's referred by to the word yajna or others, other words, it's very present. Even in the old Vedas, you hear constantly the different sacrifice or yajnas to different devas for different purposes with very specific expectations of obtaining personal things, not even on the material realm. So I will say that, let's put it this way, we will say that sacrifice is the beginning of love, no? If we take love as prem bhakti, divine love, like totally unmotivated and free from selfishness, exclusively for the pleasure of the beloved, if we want to give such a lofty definition of love, which we can, of course, and that corresponds with the Shastric definition of prem, no? Let's go to that level. We will say, okay, how to reach that level? By sacrifice, and sacrifice is a gradual thing. So the scriptures prescribe sustainable sacrifices for the point is, whenever you are in your life, at whatever point you are in your journey, you have to do some sacrifice.
Mm-hmm.
No? So you get closer to the ultimate idea of love. Now, the goal is love, but some people is very far from that. So to gradually understand and appreciate and develop a personal experience of the value of sacrifice, many times it all begins by just give a little sacrifice. Like you have in some religions, this, tithing, whatever, that they give like once a month, or 10% of their income, whatever. So it's sacrifice on some level, because it pains to take money from your pocket and give it somewhere. It's like, but you understand, no? There is a transactional thing still, maybe, but still there is some willingness to sacrifice. Ultimately, you are sacrificing your ego and your sense of identity attached to that money, in that case, for example, right? Because generally, part of our identity is, I am what I have. No, sometimes I am what I have. I am the money I have. I am the possessions I have. That's me. So giving that away on some level amounts to, okay, I'm giving up that sense of identity. And a very, again, it may sound even primitive for some people, but for some people, that's the beginning. No? Like Krishna says in the Gita, Chatur Bhida Bhajanti Mam. No? Different people approach me, Artha Jignyasra Artha Tigyani. Approach me with, surrender to me with different intentions. The one who's looking for wealth, looking for knowledge, looking for relief of pain, the wise man. And I accept all of them, Krishna says. No, I don't reject anyone. So all of them approach me and all of them do some sacrifice. So I would say that the beginning of love is some sacrifice, and that's why the Vedas through and through emphasize some form of sacrifice. Even if you, how to say, and that we've mentioned many times, even if we have to engage in some yajna to obtain heavenly delight, it sounds like paradoxical, but I want to enjoy all the delights of heaven, and in order to attain that situation, I deprive myself of all enjoyment here. Now, I engage in deep penance and austerity so I can enjoy like crazy. But at the same time, you are doing that and it works eventually. So the end result is not so much, Okay, the fruit is there. I will enjoy like crazy. The end fruit is I develop some faith in the Vedas who are which are prescribing that method. And I realize, oh, it worked. So next time I will approach scripture with an increased faith in a scripture, and that renewed faith will allow me to read the scripture in its ultimate intention and purpose, no? Which is what Krishna says in the 15th chapter of the Gita. Sarvasya jaham hridi sannivishto matasrama trinyanam pohanam cha vedaischa sarvairvidam vedanta krit veda vidivacham. I am the ultimate meaning of the Vedas, no? All the knowledge, all the scripture knowledge concludes in me. So sacrifice is there. It's a beginning of love again. It can be transactional in the beginning, but it's a gradual giving. Not like when we are a child, maybe in the beginning we are not, it's not in our system to do sacrifice. No? I'm the center of the universe. No? Use not with bad intention, no, but just our psychology has not unfolded that much. So we see everything around us as being around us. Like we see everything as if I am the center. So we are not thinking in terms of giving and dedication and self-forgetfulness and abstinence and selflessness. So gradually we need to be trained in that, no? And sometimes your parents will tell, give something, say thank you, no? Things like that. Because if not, you become a monster, basically. So it's a training into a gradual, again, sacrifice and gratefulness and giving up and realizing I'm not the center, everything does not revolve around me. So the more we realize that, there is a point when we actually realize who is the center and how we are revolving around the center and how we are supposed to relate to the center. And at some point, even the giving of love, I mean, we're talking about sacrifice, but you ultimately, how to say, when you love in the highest possible way, I wouldn't say you're feeling that as a sacrifice, no? Like something that, no, I have to love you. No, it pains, it's difficult. No, it's not, it's difficult not to do it. No. So those are the dynamics, right? But in some stage of life, of course, we are very aware of the sacrifice, and we have to use our intelligence to push ourselves in the direction of sacrifice in a sustainable way. Again, I'm not prescribing anything extreme, but also it's a health. There has to be a healthy push to put into the fire, so to say, svaha, to put into the fire of sacrifice something that we know we may be attached, that somehow is keeping us from a further depth in connection to God. And that it will be possible to put that into the fire, but for some reason I'm not doing that. So I think it's important to be sincere and say, why not? And whenever I'm doing that, as you mentioned, why I'm doing that? And there is place for realizing, okay, still in certain aspect of my practice, it's quite transactional. I'm still expecting Krishna to provide, to give me relief, to give me joy, to give me food, to give me boyfriend, to give me car, to give me job, to give me better Wi-Fi connection. I'm praying for that one here. To give me a few other things. But yeah, at one point the shift ideally has to start happening when I start to ask myself what I can give back. Because if we start to realize how much you have been given already, I mean, your very existence is a given, so to say. You have been given existence. You have been given unconditional love from time without beginning. You have been given so many things. The fact is that we are not aware of that. So sadhana implies, among many other things, awakening to the fact of how much has been already given to us. And then comes a natural question, King Kara, what can I do? How can I serve? So there's this shift in which I start to give. Of course, again, as you say, maybe we can give in a transactional spirit. In the beginning, we are not even thinking about that. In the beginning, it's all about receiving, not even giving for receiving. It's just receiving and taking from others, more like brutal, exploitative nature. Then we realize, okay, I've become a little more civilized, no? and I can understand how the world works and relationships, diplomacy, whatever. I give and I receive. I know what to give to receive what I need, something like that, right? I know what to give, how to give, what to say, so I obtain what I want. Still, it's pretty transactional. And that can happen outside of the bhakti circle as well as inside in a more refined way. But eventually, yeah, it has to be very anukul. It has to, the heart has to experience and shift in terms of being so moved that the only question that is there is now, how can I, what to do with my salvation? Again, I've been received salvation. What to do with it? How to give myself to that? And even when that's the case, it may seem that we are asking some things, but in that case, it won't be for us. Like the example you gave of Advaita Acharya, actually, that was not for him, right? Advaita was offering Tulsi and Ganga Jal for Mahaprabhu to descend, because the previous of that was he was contemplating the condition of the souls in Kali Yuga. He was immersed by compassion. He was invaded by empathy of the suffering of others. And he was like intercessory prayer, as you will say. You know? Like he was praying for Bhagavan to appear for the sake of them, not for his sake. He's Advaita Acharya, right? He has not the problems we have. So it seemed to be transactional, but it just, the only concern was compassion, which is an expression of love, right? So there's place for that as well. You know? Like Rupa Goswami is praying to Krishna, and so on. He's asking, give me thousands of tongues, give me thousands of ears. Again, you can say Rupa Goswami is being transactional here. He's asking a lot, thousands of things. But all of them are in the context of properly honoring the nectar containing these two syllables, Krishna. So he's only begging for more capabilities to love and serve, to honor the gift. So in that sense, I wouldn't turn that transactional. Again, I liked in that case the word reciprocal. He's feeling, I'm receiving so much and I'm so concerned with giving back properly as best as I can, that whatever I'm praying is in the context of that, in the context of reciprocity, of giving it back. And those are the sections also that you referred to, I think, in Chaitanya Charitamrita as well as in the Bhagavatam, when Krishna will say, I don't know, to the gopis napari ham nirabhadya sanjaya, I cannot pay the love you have given to me. Your own love is the, its own reward, but I'll try to pay it back. No? But it's not, again, it's not transactional, although the word may be used, not paying. But it's all about, like, you are receiving so much. Today I shared the quote from one beautiful verse from the Bhagavatam, probably, I don't know if to say my favorite, because that's always complex to say. One of them, Nirvairam, and anyhow, that verse there, Pujayeti Angrirayenu Bihi, no? He's saying, Krishna is saying, I always follow in the footsteps of my devotees. And in the purport, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur say that Krishna feels so much indebted. He feels that he receives so much love from his devotees that he feels that he's not giving enough in return. And because of that, he's begging for the foot, the dust of the feet of his devotees to be blessed by that foot dust, so he may be more able to reciprocate in kind to his devotees. So try to think about that for me. I mean, that's as humble as God can get, so to say, right? That's incredible. That's full, and I wouldn't say that's transactional, right? That's reciprocal. But that's reciprocal. There's a concern about how to just reciprocate with what you are receiving, and the overwhelming experience that I'm receiving so much that I cannot pay it back, but at the same time, I cannot just relax and do nothing. So I'm trying my best, but still the gift that comes is overwhelmingly greater. And we will say that, but Krishna himself is saying that. So that's the nature of love. Both sides are deeply humbled and overwhelmed by the degree of what's coming. So that takes them to have to do something about it. And that's how you live the rest of your life. That's the only question that remains, basically. So yeah. And at that point, I will say again, just to finish, you are not thinking in terms of sacrifice. No. You are just consumed by the by the inquiry about how to give myself the best. Of course, that takes you to give yourself more and more. But Srila Maharaj sometimes will make this distinction between self-sacrifice at one stage of the practice, when we are conscious that I'm sacrificing myself, I'm doing this effort, I'm putting into the fire my sarvapadi vinir moktam, my false ego, my false designations. But at another level, there's no longer self-sacrifice. There is self-forgetfulness in divine love. Your false self was so much put into the fire that in one sense you forgot about yourself in a healthy way, because you are become so much absorbed in the object of your affection that that's the only thing that remains. Again, we cannot imitate that forcefully. At certain stages, we need to think about ourselves and have proper self-love in bhakti and all that stuff. but that's the foundational bedrock work. On that foundation, at one point, you are just obsessed and concerned with loving. You already trespassed the notion of sacrifice, so to say, interestingly. But to reach such a realm, again, as we say, just to, there are so many degrees in which we are invited to give sacrifice on some level, as much as we come from where we are, a healthy dose of sacrifice on a daily basis, a healthy dose of sacrifice. Because if not, again, it's so easy to be entangled in the comfort zone, in the predictable, in the familiar, in whatever is easy to do, in whatever doesn't challenge us. And that can create, can make us stagnant. So it's important on a healthy basis, on a daily basis, to push, to pinch ourselves a little bit in that terms, and to go out of the comfort zone, out of the familiar, make some sacrifice. That's the actual spirit of this suaha that we find in scripture constantly. And of course, Krishna himself says, I am that tapasya, I am that sacrifice, I am none different. I am found in those moments, basically. No, when we are willing to let go, to give up in a healthy way for the right reasons, I'm there, he says, right? So I don't know if that makes any sense, Kevin.
Yes, it does. And the way you drew out the progression, and sacrifice does still serve our journey. I think the one thing, and it's something I will just not take up time with in this setting right now, but ponder some more, is back with that Advaita Acharya, those several verses. It seems almost in my mind that he is manipulating Krishna. Like, why won't Krishna just listen to his prayer? Why does he have to take a tulasi leaf and water to get Krishna? To me, that feels like, it's in Shastra, it just feels manipulating a little.
Okay, I get the point.
But anyways, I don't want to. I'll talk about myself. Yeah. Maybe reach out to you.
I mean, I will mention something briefly. Of course, Krishna the Gita says, Patram Pushpam Palantoyam, you offer me flower, fruit, water, anything. But with bhakti, and I'm there, basically, he's saying. And twice the word bhakti appears in that verse, Gita 9:26. So the spirit of the offering is always our heart. So our heart and sincere calling is what makes Krishna come. Externally, there can be a flower, a fruit, water. So externally, it may seem that transactional, in terms of Advaita resorting to this particular method of tulsi leaves and Ganges, but actually what makes Mahaprabhu descend is Advaita's crying and compassion. No, and many other places in the scripture when it is described, which are the main reasons for Mahaprabhu to appear are these three main reasons in terms of tasting Radha Bhav. But the external reasons for Mahaprabhu to appear are mentioned, that is the calling of Advaita and the chanting of Haridas Thakur. So the calling of Advaita is not so much like the method and the ritual and the water and the belief, but it's the crying. And he's an Acharya and he's a Brahmin. So out externally, overtly, he's following the protocol, so to say, of certain ritual, etc. To, again, Acharya giving an example how there is a certain way of doing things, But at the same time, as we know, devoid of the inner spirit, those rituals are just a formality. But also the formality can help to enter into the inner spirit of the ritual and the offering. It's not that Advaita Acharya needs that, but many of us may need that. Many of us may not just spontaneously cry and call Krishna, may need to sit and prepare a sacred place and decorate and invoke a fire. And it starts to put us into a sacred space, although every space is sacred, but we don't have that perception yet. So Advaita Acharya is following that protocol and sitting and having all the paraphernalia in place. To give the example, to mention how important that is, and of course to highlight another point is to highlight how dear Tulsi is to Krishna and how dear Ganges is to Krishna, to highlight the sacredness of these particular items. So there are many purposes, but ultimately it's about his crying and calling, which what makes Mahaprabhu descend. That's the main explanation. So, but thank you for further clarifying your question.
Thank you. That helps a lot. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Okay, Rasangi. Yeah.
Like perfect questions, perfect answers. So cool. You know what I mean?
I don't know. Can always become more perfect. So we are always in process. No problem.
I know it's process. Maharaj, I just pronounced to you, by the way. Thanks for your birthday wishes. I love that you're so personal. Thank you.
There's no other way to do it. And, the other option is impersonalism. You choose.
And I just want to say that I saw a podcast the other day of Nama Ras with my godbrother Mahatma Das, Mahatma Prabhu.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole title of it was Devotees Don't Care Enough About Themselves.
Yeah, I saw the title, yeah.
And through the whole thing, I was so impressed. I know him from years, but I'm so impressed how he guides his disciples. And mm-hmm. I think, you're helping to demystify that. And he was explaining how he does that, and it's a really personal thing, like helping them maintain faith during hard times, developing resilience. You know what I mean? It's not just like mystical and like it's teaching and guiding. I found it so refreshing. And not only that, he was speaking about how Krishna loves us unconditionally. And I was wondering if you'd been talking with him. Because, you know what I mean? We hear this for many years, but nobody has devoted that much time to that topic. So I was just really delighted to hear him. And I told him I find it very refreshing. And it's somebody like that that you would want to take shelter of and guide you. He's honest. He talked about his own difficulties with his wife, his challenges. You know what I mean? I mean, it was very honest. Anyway, my question is, in this chapter on non-duality, you make some really profound statements, like there cannot be personality without non-duality. There cannot be personality without non-duality. And then you go on to say, why? Can I read this? And then you comment?
It's not too long, yes.
Not too long. I just wanted to give the context, because that's the nature of the divine. He is not the non-dual supreme person. He's the inside, the outside, and everywhere in between. He is all of the past, all of the future, and all of the present. In fact, we cannot be separated from him for even a moment. Now, appreciating, at least theoretically, this simple but most mysterious fact can change our entire orientation to life. Wow. And then you say that non-duality is the ship in relationship that makes it possible for us to navigate and relate to one another. And that means relating not only intimately, but unlimitedly, because the non-dual is nothing but an unlimited presence. My question is, how would I be seeing things if I were seeing everything non-dually? How do you see the misbehavior of others and the the things that go on in the world if we're seeing non-dually.
Okay, thank you. So, first of all, yes, I've been in contact with Mahatma Prabhu, but some time ago, not recently, but yeah, last year or maybe beginning of this year, we had a few exchanges, and he has my book, so I don't know how much he could read it, but yeah, I was happy to know that he was talking on that topic. I was with Navrasa those days when the podcast was published, and I've seen that many devotees saw it, so that also made me happy because that shows how much there is a need to talk and hear about those things. So that on one side. So thank you for mentioning that and commenting that. So regarding your question and the excerpt you read, big part of that section was also inspired by some comments that Bhakti Rasa made when I shared with her the manuscript. So a big round of applause go for her, especially as part of the ship in relationship. I think that was her. I'm not as smart as getting to that way of saying things. So, but yeah, and that's a very important point, the idea that we need non-duality for relationship. Although for some people that may sound the opposite, and people may think, if you bring non-duality, diversity is over, right? But the main point is the opposite, is unless everything is resting on a foundation of non-duality, which means everything is connected already, how can I relate to you if I have nothing in common with you? If we are absolutely disconnected, how we can have a relationship? If we have nothing in common whatsoever, how there can be any relationship? It's not possible. But fortunately, it's possible because there is a foundation of non-duality. And as I mentioned in my book, no, we need to talk about non-duality more. We need to de-demonize, de-stigmatize non-duality, because for many time we just equated non-duality with impersonalism, and that's wrong. I mean, of course, impersonalists will say, are non-dual as well, but non-dualism is not impersonalism. That's not the same. Because if we battle against non-duality, we are basically battling against our own tradition. We are basically canceling the Srimad Bhagavatam, which says reality is non-dual. And the whole subject of the Bhagavatam is non-dual reality, as I mentioned in my book. Is right there in the very conclusion of the Bhagavatam. The whole topic is Advitya, non-duality. And what's the absolute Advaigyan Tattva, non-dual consciousness? So non-duality means everything, again, is connected. There's no separatedness. No? There are no isolated units floating absolutely fragmented from each other. It's not possible. So that gives us a whole, holistic, a comprehensive, all-encompassing orientation to life. So I think it's important, even in theory, to dedicate some time to ruminate and process and train ourselves in that. Not like even sitting and looking all around you and realizing, okay, nothing of what I'm seeing is disconnected. Not all of this is existing, revolving around the orbit of Krishna in the center, on the all-attractive magnetic force that is Bhagavan Sri Krishna lies in the center of reality, unconditional love lies in the center of reality, and every single atom and whatever I cannot even perceive nor imagine is still interconnected and revolving around that center. So on that foundation in place, even in theory and hopefully pursuing that theory as in practice, so it becomes a vision, we can address the mischief of conditioned souls with a little bit more bigger picture and compassion and understanding in mind. Because basically, as we were talking the other day, I think it was on the lecture on evolution in divine love, the ones I'm giving on Tuesday. And I was mentioning that ultimately there is, and I mentioned this many times, ultimately there's not many problems There's only one problem. And the only problem is basically this. We could say the only problem is we are not aware that reality is non-dual. The only problem is duality. The only problem is separatedness. That's the only problem. We see things and people and circumstances and everything disconnected. That's the only problem. When you solve that problem, there are no problems. That's the only problem. And every other so-called problem is a symptom of that only problem. So as much as you address and solve and uproot that only problem, there are no more problems. So when we see people doing horrible stuff in this world, I mean, we have great potential for that. We have ever-evolving potential. We have ever-devolving potential. So that basically speaks about how distracted we are of this fact of non-dual reality, how much we are obsessed, haunted by separatedness. That's basically what's going on. Even if that person thinks it's something else, we know that's what's going on. No. So whatever pain and suffering and mischief we may be causing or receiving is all in connection from this distraction from the fact that reality is whole and interconnected, and as in the words of Father Richard Rohr, everything belongs. No. So if I don't have that vision and that realization that everything belongs, I feel that I don't belong, and I may extend that sense of not belonging to everything else. So I will treat reality accordingly. No, I will relate to everything as if it doesn't belong, as if it's not valuable. And I, of course, will mistreat everything and everyone, including myself. Mm-hmm. But when I understand that everything is already part of a sacred whole, there is nothing to mistreat. There is everything to honor and venerate and worship and love and nourish, because all is integrated into that non-dual center. Mm-hmm. So I will say that, no? Again, and that will that could also instill compassion from a more profound place. When we have a proper understanding of what takes people to do things that are creating suffering and confusion and so many things, when we have a clear understanding of the cause of that, of the root problem, we can address their situation with proper, accurate understanding, which means also accurate compassion to really solve the problem and not just relieve the symptom of the problem, which is not the same. So, I mean, sometimes we may need to relieve the symptom in the immediate, but then knowing what's the actual root of the problem, we can try to go together to that place of helping that person realize the center of reality is unconditional love, and everything exists without being separated from that, although we have great capacity to become distracted from that fact. And of course, we have to embody that unconditional love ourselves to give people a glimpse, a taste of that center. And that will give them an undeniable experience that that's true, that that's a fact. And that will open to them a whole, complete, totally different paradigm and perspective and potential and way of living life. And probably that's the best thing, the best thing they will receive to stop doing the nonsense they may be doing, including us. We also do our nonsense, of course. I'm not talking here about other people also. So, yeah. What do you think?
Well, great
Does it
answer.
Make sense?
Yes, I loved it so much. And I heard something yesterday that I liked that stuck in my mind. Our job is not to see through others, but to see them through. I don't know where I heard that. Maybe I read it in your book. But
No, that was not me. I won't take the copyright from that one.
Isn't that cool though? That puts
I never heard it, so I don't know.
It puts a different slant. Like, we don't have to see and nitpick. What we're here to help see people through stuff,
mm-hmm.
through to the other side, to a better place, perhaps. I love that.
Yeah. And again, we need to remind each other about who we are, as simple as that sounds, of course, and who we are connected with, what we are part of already, where do we belong already. But again, it's not just giving people mere theory. No, you already belong. Christians in the center, so don't lament, don't do nonsense, be enlightened. Good luck. You have to give them a direct, personal, somatic experience of that through yourself. So that will convince them. That will convert them. The experience will convert them, not you, but the experience. So,
thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, we have to, at the end of the day, that's a message, that's the service. We have to be agents of unconditional love. As we are receiving that agency, we have to properly represent it to ourselves, to whomever is around us. And yeah. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
So let's turn to the next question. So far is the last one from Rajendra. So you can unmute yourself, Rajendraji.
Hare Krishna Maharaj, Dhanvad Pranam. Nice to see you.
The same.
Maharaj, my question is related to chanting of the holy name.
Okay.
In Shastra, we hear so much glorification of the holy name, and you also mentioned earlier, quoting Rupa Goswami, that chanting of the holy name seems to be most important thing in Kali Yuga for attaining love of Godhead. But with our practice, it seems so far away from, you know, our experience, that sometimes we just chant, but we don't really have that faith or hope that we'll ever, you know, be able to experience such things. I don't know. So how to, you know, gain the proper perspective about that?
So if I understood the question correctly, well, most of these how questions generally are replied by, I don't want to sound it very a dogmatic one-liner, but it's keep practicing in good company. I mean, sounds simple, but there is so much there. You know, we shouldn't underestimate those statements, but we should also be able to go deep into those statements. Now, what does it mean? Proper company, good association, practice. No, it's not just, again, mechanical repetition in a social environment that is not necessarily conducive, but it's just, I'm there because there are some exciting social dynamics or whatever. So yeah, the way to progress in chanting is by being close to people who we feel that they are chanting from a better place than I'm chanting. They're better situated in terms of their relationship with the name. They are more, dedicated internally to that relationship. I can feel that. I have an experience of that. They transmit me something when they talk, when I'm with them, when I'm hear them, whatever the case. And of course, chant myself. It's not just, okay, I'll keep myself close to those who are chanting and get all the credit. So something like that without chanting myself. And in the process of chanting myself, of course, one of the main questions that come, if we are not experiencing what we are supposed to experience, so to say, of course, what does it mean also? I'm not experiencing what I'm supposed to experience. Well, if you are, for example, if you chant and you feel that you don't feel nothing, you are feeling something already. You feel that you don't feel nothing. So do something with that. Why I don't feel nothing? Why? And then you have to be introspective. You have to ask yourself, why I'm not feeling anything? Why? Of course, the chanting is not about feeling also. Again, an important point. It's not just, Okay, I'm chanting, so I feel a lot of things. You ultimately, we don't want to use the chanting to feel things ourselves. Like the whole purpose of the chanting is that I feel things. Now, you ultimately, as I replied to Kevin, is the concern is how can I make the name feel something? How can I chant for their pleasure? How can I just chant the name for the pleasure of the name? Or Radha and Krishna, non-different from the name. Ideally, how can I stop concerning myself with feeling something? That's another way of deconstructing the practice, because many times we are just feeling oriented, so to say, right? Goal oriented, feeling oriented. Okay, I'm doing this, what I'm supposed to feel ideally by doing this. And until and unless that's not happening, my practice is a failure. And probably that's not the case. Sometimes I may be chanting and not feeling anything. And I can, as we were talking the other day with someone, and I can be sincerely praying and chanting because I'm not feeling anything. I'm trying to chant from it. I'm feeling something because I'm not feeling anything. That's what Mahaprabhu is teaching in the second verse of Shikshastakam, Durdaiva Midrishami Hajjanina Anurag. That's an important lesson. That second verse is about Anartha Nivritti and Bhajana Kriya, the stage. Now, each verse of Shikshastakam corresponds with different stages in bhakti. So the second verse implies you are practicing, but still considerable anarthas gets in the way of your practice. So Mahaprabhu shares three lines of that in that verse. The first three lines of the verse are appreciation for the gifts of bhakti, what's in the name. Nam namakari bahudaniya sharva saktis tatrar pitaniyamita smaranena kaha tadrishita bhakri bhagavan. No, such is your mercy, Bhagavan. There are unlimited names. All of them are full of your shakti. There are no hard and fast rules to chant them. Wow. No, those are the three first lines. Wow. And then comes the fourth line. Durdaiva midrishami hajjanina anurag. But I'm so unfortunate that I have no attraction for them. And he's feeling regret. He's feeling bad about it. He's feeling bad because of not feeling anything for how good and incredible are the gifts present in the name. So that's something. That's my point. That's progress. If you get to that point of feeling something like that, it's not that I'm not praying to Krishna for millions of years and tongues. I'm not crying. I'm not rolling on the ground. I'm not trembling. I'm not experiencing all these symptoms. Who say that you have to experience all those things? That may come as a byproduct, but it's not that they're chanting for that. Like someone like Rupa Goswami is experiencing all those things. He's not thinking, let me tremble, let me cry, let me roll on the ground, let me feel things. That's not their concern. So Mahaprabhu is, and again, we have to identify where we are. No? Where are we? Swe swe dikari janista saguna parikirtita, says the Bhagavatam. To being able to ascertain your own adhikar, that's real beauty and real piety. And to know where you are and to live and practice from that place of realism and coherence, that's beautiful, says the Bhagavatam. So if I understand, I'm in a certain stage with my main feeling is not so much divine ecstasy, but healthy repentance, or accepting humbling failure. Now, sometimes we have talked, we may have at times moments of inspiring hope. We receive some epiphany and we need that. I'm not saying that will never come. We need that inspiring hope, nourishing inspiration. So, but then we will have also humbling failure. Inspiring hope and humbling failure. We will navigate between these two. So we may fail also miserably. So to say fail. But if it's humbling, it's not failure. That's my point. Okay, I'm not feeling anything for Krishna. Is that failure? Well, it all depends what you do with that. If you take that not feeling anything, and that makes you humble, and that makes you pray, and that opens your heart because of a pain of not feeling anything, that's not failure. That's success. And Krishna is taking a special note of how you behave in those moments where you don't feel anything. especially in those moments where you are struggling, where you are not feeling anything, and you are sincerely addressing him with an open heart and begging for mercy and shelter, he's taking special note. Although you may not feeling too much in those moments, that's where Krishna is hearing you most attentively. Let's put it that way. Follow my point. So in that sense, it's absolute success, although you are feeling yourself a failure. So that's a paradox. Well, that's how it works. So it's not so much like, Maharaj, give me the magical formula so I can perform my chanting perfectly and ecstatically. That doesn't work like that. That's not what Mahaprabhu is showing in the Sikshastakam. There is a place for going through this grieving, failure, crying from that place, sincere repentance, humility, and openness. And some moments we will be celebrating life and celebrating the gift, becoming really aware of that and crying because of that. Some other days, maybe we are not, we lost sight of that for whatever reason, and we'll be crying because of that. There are so many reasons to cry in a proper way, according to our stage. So, and Krishna is taking note of all of that, if we are sincere. So I will say that's the main thing. Trying to remain honest, present to where I am, honest to where I'm feeling, I'm not feeling, reacting accordingly, whether it's celebrating the grace, the unconditional love, the gifts, the possibilities, or lamenting in a healthy way, in a humbling way, that I'm not as connected as I would like. And all this attracts mercy, of course. So I will say more like that, not like trying to connect with where I am in the present moment and how to say, honoring whatever I am in the present moment. That's it. Not like by being honest about it. It's not so much goal-oriented. No, sometimes our practice is too goal-oriented. It should be more presence-oriented, no, oriented to be present where we are, to be honest, where we are right here, right now. Not so much where I have to reach, where I have to end, what I have to attain. No, because if not, it can become more an egotistic performance. Like, I have to reach that place. I'm not perfect yet. I have to be feeling that I'm here. I have to reach there. Instead of where I am now and what I have to acknowledge, fully embrace in the here and now with full sincerity and openness, and that, and trusting that that will take me to whatever I have to be taken, basically. And trusting that Krishna is taking profound note of those moments of deep honesty. So I will say that's an ideal spirit to embrace the chanting, and to be open to whatever Sri Sri Radha and Krishna want to reveal to us in those particular moments. And being very careful not to over expect and over idealize how things should look, what should happen. We have some, of course, some descriptions of stages and experiences, but each journey is individual, and there are different ups and downs and different very unique specific things to our case. So it's not that things will happen in a certain sequence, predictable, after this comes this and before that should come this. Each journey is unique, huh? Radically personal. So we have to honor that journey properly. So each day brings its own gifts. Each day brings its own lessons and invitations. So that's invitation of every day. That's why we wake up every single day, hopefully. Not like open and attentive to, okay, what's the message today? What's the portal today? What's the door today? What's the grace today? What's the lesson today? What's the transformation today? If I'm not asking those questions, I've wasted my day, basically, because each day is bringing an answer to each of those questions. And the chanting moment or the prayer moment, every moment, but let's begin from there. It's a moment to ask those questions, to hear the answer to those questions, and hopefully to live the rest of my day trying to honor those answers and justify my existence on that day. And next day, let's talk again tomorrow. That's another whole different chapter. No? So that's what I will say today, Rajendra. I hope that helps.
Thank you, Maharaj.
I trust you will be able to do something with all that bunch of words. But
Yes,
hopefully it's not
definitely.
hopefully it's not only a bunch of words.
That was very helpful, Marcus. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, so I'm not seeing any more raised hands, and we're almost an hour and a half, so I think we had a good time together, good interaction. So I think we can put it to rest there and start another chapter of ruminating and processing and integrating and how we can express this today, tomorrow, and so on and so forth till we meet each other next Saturday. And of course, for those who know or not know, but every Tuesday we are also getting together for a series of lectures I'm giving on as a preview of the book I'm writing that yesterday I finished writing it. My part now comes editing and all that stuff that may take a long time, more than what I took to write it. But at least my part is there, quote unquote. So yeah, we are talking on that. So those who are not connected are of course invited to do that. I'm always sharing the link in my social media every week. We are talking about evolution in divine love. Not only how divine love is in evolution, but how can evolution fall in love and be in divine love and evolve and grow and express itself through God as this world and everything in constant ongoing expansion. The journey goes on. So those interested, of course, can join. There is a link for that. If you don't know it, you can contact me personally, or maybe Bhakti Rasa can share it in the chat here now for those who are connected. So maybe we see each other on Tuesday, and if not, hopefully see you next Saturday for our next Istogosti. Sriman Mahaprabhu ki jai, Sri Hari Nam Sankirtan ki jai, Sri Sri Gaur Nityananda Gaur Gadadhar ji ki jai, Sri Sri Radha Madan Mohan Raghavinda Dev Radha Gopinath ji ki jai, Gaur Bhaktavrinda ki jai, Gaur Priman Hari Bol, Pancha Kalpataru Vyascha, Vibhas Hindupyai Vacha, Patitanam Pavani.